Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ravi Agrawal, Foreign Policy's Editor-in-Chief. This is FP Live. Welcome to the show. A recent survey of U.S. foreign policy reveals a startling change. For the first time in nearly five decades, a majority of Republicans say the United States should stay out of world affairs rather than play an active role in it. The Chicago Council survey, conducted by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, found that the shift was led primarily by so-called Trump Republicans, the 47% of Republicans who hold a very favorable view of Donald Trump. Now, debates about America's role in the world are hardly new, nor is the argument that Washington would be better off focusing on domestic issues. What seems new, however, is the concentration of people who hold those views, not only in one party, but specifically within the pro-Trump wing of the GOP. I wanted to explore this week how that change has taken place, and with that, what impact it's already had and will have on U.S. foreign policy. Well, my guest this week is Ivo Dalder. He's the CEO of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which conducted the survey. He's also a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. So we also spent some time looking at the state of the war in Ukraine. Ivo's really one of the best analysts to read and listen to on this topic. As always, if you like the podcast, rate us, share it with a friend, or try us on video live on foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to ask questions too, as you know. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. Okay, let's dive in. Ivo Dalder, welcome back.
Hey, Ravi, it's wonderful to be here.
Great, as always. So let's begin with a study your team conducted. Republicans have usually been more likely than Democrats to favor an active role abroad, and your surveys have consistently proven that out. This year, there's a change. Explain that.
Well, there's been two kinds of changes. One is a little slower. That is, Republicans have increasingly, since about 2016, become more and more skeptical about the United States playing an active role in world affairs. And more favorable for staying out of world affairs. This is the question we've been asking for 50 years. And in fact, Gallup has been asking since the 1940s. But something bigger happened just in the last survey, which we did late last year, which was that the first time ever since we asked that question, more Republicans wanted to stay out of world affairs than play an active role in world affairs. And that's never happened before. So you have this secular change over time in the last decade or so of Republicans becoming more and more, let's say, isolationist vis-a-vis Democrats. And then all of a sudden, this major shift that is happening in the party on the question of whether to stay involved or not. And that major shift can really be explained, and that's what the study tried to do, by one part of the Republican Party. So what we did is we divided the Republican responses between those who had a very favorable view of Donald Trump, and we called those Trump Republicans, and those who had a somewhat or even unfavorable view of Donald Trump, and we called those non-Trump Republicans. About 47% of the Republican respondents in our survey are Trump Republicans and 53% non-Trump Republicans. So breaking up, maybe 50-50. And then if you look at these questions, the gap becomes really significant. So only 40% of Trump Republicans, just think about that, 40% want the United States to play an active role in the world. 52% of non-Trump Republicans are still in favor of that. In fact, a majority of non-Trump Republicans want the United States to remain actively involved in the world, just as Republicans overall have long done. So that's where it is. It's all in this change within the party, as well as in the party writ large. But it's really the change within the party that is driving this.
So that's what the data shows. And I'm wondering if you're able to explain why these changes might be taking place, not just for the Republican Party at large, but also this specific group of so-called Trump Republicans.
Well, the data doesn't give you the answers to that, but we, you know, a larger qualitative analysis of what's going on in the country does give you some views. So when you look at the American electorate writ large over the last 80 years or so, or certainly the 50 years that we've been looking at these data, it's been split about two-third, one-third between those who believe the United States should be actively engaged and those who should who believe that the United States should not be actively engaged. But that core of the, let's call it the isolationist American core, tended to be actually more Democratic than Republican and more independent than either Democratic or Republican. And what has happened is that that core has become increasingly Republican in terms of its voting preference. So it isn't that isolationism is growing in the country writ large, although it's shifting a bit as it has over time, just because of the way the world is evolving. It's really that a particular core has been mobilized. People who feel left behind, who worry about immigration, who are less and less concerned about what's happening in other countries and more concerned about what's happening in our own country, whether it goes under Ukraine versus the border or whatever way you want to talk about it in policy terms. But that group of people, which have existed but tended to be dispersed between the parties, is now concentrated and frankly has been mobilized by Donald Trump. And you cannot really explain any of this without focusing on Donald Trump and his singular focus on a foreign policy, and what he calls an America First foreign policy, what others might call an America Alone or America Disengaged foreign policy. He has been able to mobilize this longstanding, more isolationist part of the American electorate and bring them into the Republican fold. And that is, I think, one of the things that's happening on Capitol Hill. It's what's happening in the country writ large when it comes to the kinds of issues that you mentioned in your introduction, whether it's Ukraine or support for alliances or indeed American leadership abroad.
And one of the interesting things in that survey is that there seems to be less interest in, say, Ukraine or the Middle East or alliances. But then these same Trump Republicans think that U.S. leaders are not paying enough attention to the U.S.-Mexico border or to U.S.-China competition or to Iran's nuclear program. Can you explain that? I mean, how are these issues that different from, say, Ukraine or the Middle East?
Well, just listen to what Donald Trump talks about when he talks about these kinds of issues. The number one issue he raises is the border, and he did that when he came down the golden escalator in Trump Tower in 2015 and railed against rapists and other people coming into our country. That was in 2015. He still does the same thing every day. And so the focus on the border is very much one that that Trump has made his signature initiative. In fact, so much so that he doesn't want to solve the issue because he wants to keep it for the election. When there was a bipartisan bill which was focused only on border security, never done before, but we always had a bill that looked at immigration reform and border security. This was just border security, a Senate bill that was negotiated by one of the most conservative Republican senators, Senator Lankford from Oklahoma. Trump said, don't vote on it because I need the issue for the election. So that's one reason. China is the bugaboo of most Americans, but certainly of the Republican Party. In fact, those who are still interested in engaging with the world now are arguing that we can't afford to focus on Ukraine. We need to focus on China. That was the message that J.D. Vance, the senator from Ohio, brought to Munich at the security conference. He said, we just can't afford to do what we need to do to support Ukraine while at the same time focusing on deterring and, if necessary, defeating China and or the Chinese Communist Party, as they like to put it. And that's something that Trump talks about as well in terms of trade and other issues. And then Iran, remember, there was a deal that the United States negotiated with Iran and other countries in Europe to sort of halt the nuclear program and to lengthen the time between the moment it would break out of the deal and the moment it would have a nuclear weapon. That was agreed by under the Obama administration in 2015, and Trump ran against that in 2016. And as soon as he had the chance, he walked away from that deal. And so these are three major issues: the border, China, Iran, nuclear weapons, that are top of Donald Trump's worldview about how to deal with it. We'll do it alone. We won't do it with allies. We will do it through force and sanctions and tariffs and building walls and creating gates to prevent people from coming in. So it's not surprising that a core of the Republican Party that has been mobilized by Donald Trump would look at those three issues as the three that they think need more attention, while other issues that Donald Trump doesn't talk about, whether it's Ukraine or strengthening our alliances or opening up markets overseas, that those get less attention and less support.
But Ivo, it seems to me that the through line across all of these issues is basically what Trump is talking about, based on what you're saying, and less a broader sense of, you know, this is what America's priorities need to be because of X, Y, or Z reasons.
Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, I think an overwhelming majority of Americans still support aid to Ukraine, are strongly supportive of our alliances, NATO included, and believe that the Americans should engage in the world writ large. It's a little less today than it was in years past on all those issues, but mainly because of one thing, because the Trump Republicans are pulling away and pulling down the overall support numbers. And they are Trump Republicans because Trump mobilized. And without Donald Trump, you wouldn't have this. So I think it's very important to understand that what's happening is not some kind of secular change, that America is becoming more isolationist as a whole, or that America wants to retreat from the world, which is how we see it. No, there is one major political force in this country led by a singular individual who has been able to mobilize a movement. Not that that sentiment didn't exist, but it wasn't as salient. It wasn't used as a means to mobilize political power. And it is now. That's why it's getting more attention. But if you ask the simple question, do you think America should continue to provide military aid to Ukraine? Over 60%. The last poll that the council did just a week ago was 61% of Americans still believe that. That's 3 out of 5 Americans still believing that we should provide aid to Ukraine. There were 70 senators, and if you actually count it right, there's 73 senators who favored aid to Ukraine in the last vote. Three Democrats voted against it, not because of Ukraine, but because of the Israel part of the package. And if you put the vote up on Capitol Hill, you have an overwhelming majority in the House in favor of Ukraine aid as well. So I think it's a mistake to think that the country as a whole is becoming more isolationist, that it wants to retreat from responsibility, that it doesn't understand that the United States benefits from engaging in the world and, in fact, leading around the world. I think most Americans get it. It just happens to be that a major political force in our country is mobilizing in the opposite direction, and that is the issue that we need to deal with.
And the person at the head of that force could potentially even be in the White House within a year. I have some terrific questions, very thoughtful questions coming in from our subscribers, and I want to put a few of them to you. Andrew Whiting asks, to what extent is the skepticism towards involvement in overseas conflicts a reflection of changing demographics, with the U.S. population becoming more diverse and millennials reaching positions of influence? Or do you think it's mostly a reflection of U.S. citizens being tired of becoming the world's policemen?
Well, I think, I mean, demographic data demonstrates that there isn't really a lot of difference among different demographics on the overall view. They are pretty representative of the overall view of the United States. It is always the case that younger voters and younger people tend to have a slightly more isolationist, less engaging view of the world than older people, but that's been the case. And it turns out that people who were young and were more isolationist over time became more and more willing to engage in the world. I mean, the Vietnam generation clearly didn't believe that engaging in the world, particularly in the way we were doing in the late 60s and early 70s, was the right way. Well, that's not a that is the baby boom generation, and they are the generation that is most willing to have a U.S. leadership role in the world. So it's partly something that is that happens in the way society and people move. I really do believe that ultimately it has more to do with what has happened in the world. I mean, if you are a millennial, you look back at the last 20 years of American engagement. You've been engaged in two major wars, one in Iraq, one in Afghanistan, both failures in extraordinary ways. Afghanistan, we spent 20 years, spent $1 trillion, only to have the same government back in power after 20 years that we had ousted at the beginning. In Iraq, we went to war in order to remove Saddam Hussein and got Iran to be our bigger enemy in that part of the world. We had a financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, which touched many Americans deeply, younger Americans in particular. We had the election of Donald Trump, which many young people did not see as a shining moment for our country. And we had COVID as a pandemic. So you look back, if you're 40 years old, you look back at what the world looked like as an American, and it doesn't always look very positively. And that will have an impact on how you think about things, quite apart from your ethnic or other background. But ultimately, even in those age cohorts, support for American engagement remains stronger than opposition.
Fascinating. Another subscriber question. Edward Goldstein asks what criteria we should use to distinguish between a vital national interest and overreach. So put another way, given finite resources, but seemingly infinite good reasons to intervene in given situations, he says moral, economic, geopolitical, national security, anything else, how should we be making those kinds of decisions today?
So it's an age-old question that scholars in international relations and others, practitioners of American foreign policy and national security policy, have been dealing with for a very, very long time. The fundamental presumption of American engagement in the world, it may not always have been true, but it is a presumption, is that engaging is not a zero-sum game. It's a positive-sum game. That by engaging in the world and working together with states that are like-minded, that are friendly, that share our values, we can actually achieve much more than not engaging in the world and not working with them. And in that sense, that engagement is a positive-sum outcome, not a negative-sum outcome. What does that mean? It means that you can't just look at what are the resources the United States brings to a fight or to an area or to an issue and say, well, if you devote X number of resources for this issue, that means you have Y minus X for that issue. Well, no, actually, if you engage in the right way and you bring in allies and partners in that process, then actually you may have X, Y plus X kind of resources because you're bringing others in. So take the issue of China and competition with China as one of those examples. If you look at the semiconductor and chip and other industries where we're trying to compete, prevent China from having the most advanced technologies because they can use that to enhance not only their economic, but much more importantly, their military power, then we can try to do that on our own. But the problem is that the Dutch, there's a Dutch factory that manufactures the systems for the most advanced semiconductor creations. There's critical supplies from the Japanese and the Koreans and, of course, the Taiwanese, who are home to the most advanced chip production fabs in the world. So we do it by ourselves. There's a limit to how effective we can be. But if we do it with other countries, then we are much more likely to achieve the goals that we're trying to achieve at a cost that is acceptable to us. So I think part of how to think about this and part of the debate that we need to have is to get away from this idea that anything I put in to a system is something I can't use anywhere else. No, in fact, it may enhance your capacity to deal with the problems that you have. So we'll get maybe to NATO in a minute, but that's what NATO is about. This whole idea that it's about how much does each country spend, 2% or not 2%, you know, that's an input measure. It's fine. It's one of the things you care about. I mean, if nobody spends on defense, you're not going to have any defense capability. But that's not the point of the alliance. The point of the alliance is that together, that the whole is much larger than the sum of the parts. And yet, if we keep saying, we will not protect you unless you pay your bills, which is what Donald Trump keeps on arguing, that's a zero-sum view of the world that, frankly, isn't how the real world works and should work. And that's what I think part of the debate in our election should be about.
Mm. A final question about the survey, and it strikes me that, you know, on the one hand, you have the Trump Republicans as you know, an outlier, a force that clearly is changing its views over time. But even more broadly, as you yourself have said, that there is a general sort of shift in the broader American public, or at least a recognition of some of the problems of the last 20 years, Iraq, Afghanistan, that America's been involved with. I'm curious what impact you see any of these shifts in American attitudes having on actual policy and vice versa. And Afghanistan's a good example of this because, you know, in policy terms, there are many analysts who could argue that it was disastrous, but it didn't actually have much by way of political consequences for the Biden White House, in part, I'm guessing, because of some of the broader shifts you've been describing.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. So I think Americans have, you know, as Obama used to say, they're okay with war, but just not dumb wars. And clearly what happened from 2001 onwards is that we engaged in two very dumb wars in a very dumb way. And Americans came over time to appreciate that. After the shock of 9/11 wore off, we came to appreciate that we were engaged in a fool's errand. And had major implications. It led to the election of Barack Obama. There's no doubt that that 2008, the election would have been different if sentiment, particularly among young people, against Iraq and Afghanistan wars, particularly Iraq at that point, had not been as negative as it was. And it was, you know, Obama had run and could rightly say that he had been against the war from the very beginning and warned against it, gave a major speech in 2002. I think one of the reasons that John Kerry lost in 2004 when he tried to challenge George Bush is because he, as he so famously said, was for the war before he was against it. And that sort of, well, you know, why not go with the guy who's actually know what he wants? It was kind of the attitude at that time. So, yes, I do think there are secular changes. In the 1990s, under the Clinton administration, there was a greater sense that one can use military force to bring about internal change in societies, that you could use force and military means to deal with humanitarian issues, whether it was in Somalia or in Haiti or in northern Iraq or indeed in Bosnia. I think by the early part of this century, a consensus emerged, which was strengthened by what happened in Afghanistan and Iraq, that actually that's a fool's errand, that mm-hmm. people like Colin Powell, who had warned against this, were right, that you couldn't use military force to change the internal dynamics of countries, and that trying to do so could backfire. And I think we are now living in a world in which how we think about the use and deployment of military force is very different. Now, part of it is because We had major enemies, Russia and China, reemerging as major strategic power threats that we are trying to contain and deter. And so we don't have the resources to deal with those other sorts of issues. But it is also, I think, an appreciation that we need to reassess. And I think that's what Biden did when he pulled out of Afghanistan. I was in the Obama administration when then Vice President Biden was a lonely voice against escalation in Afghanistan back in 2009, 2010. He was always against this. He thought it was the wrong war and we were pursuing it in the wrong way. And the moment he became president, he said, I'm not going to do what everybody else did and prolong something that everybody knows is a fool's errand. I'm just going to pull out. And the manner what he did is less was, of course, not as great as it should have been. But the fact that he pulled out was very consistent with where the American public is. You don't hear a lot of people running around saying, oh, I would vote for Joe Biden today, but for the fact that he pulled out of Afghanistan where we should have been. I just don't think that that's where the American public
is. And that's despite the fact that the pullout itself was botched. So you're
exactly. Although, you know, if you look at opinion polling, the moment in which Biden's popularity goes underwater is, in fact, the reemergence of COVID back in with the Omicron strain in 2021 in August in the summer of 2021 and pulling out of Afghanistan. And he's never recovered as a result.
And you are listening to Foreign Policy Live. Remember, you can watch these conversations live and on video on our website, foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to send us questions in advance, in addition to a range of other benefits, including our magazine. Sign up. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. That's FPLIVE, one word.
Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
So I want to shift this discussion a bit now to Europe, especially given your experience as a diplomat there. How do you think America's NATO allies are seeing surveys such as yours and also comments from Trump that he may not support NATO if he returns to power? A lot of people have been talking of late about Trump-proofing NATO or Trump-proofing Europe. How do you think they're actually seeing this and what can they do?
They're petrified. And I was in Munich and the Munich Security Conference, big annual conference that looks at sort of the Davos or Academy Awards for Security Policy Wonks this year. There were two real big fears that Europeans expressed. One, a very serious concern with Russia and not just about what was happening in Ukraine, although at the day, the very day that the conference started, two things happened. The death of Alexei Navalny was known, and Ukraine withdrew from Avdiivka, the small town that the Russians had been trying to capture for the last 10 years in the Donetsk region. So Ukraine was very much on people's minds, but it was more than that. It was the idea that the Russians were moving towards a war economy and very much putting themselves in the position as soon as perhaps 3 years, but certainly within this decade from now, to be able to take military action and take the military threat directly to NATO. So that was one sort of wake-up call, which frankly, I'll be honest, I don't hear and see in the U.S. in the same way. Now, when you are living in Estonia, or in Finland, or even in Germany, Russia looms a little larger than if you live in Peoria or Chicago. So it's understandable, but it looms large, and it looms large not just in the East, but in Western Europe as well. But then secondly, real concern about the United States. And again, two things. One, the fact that the U.S. Congress was not able to provide and has not yet been able to provide aid to Ukraine. Here is a country that led the effort both to prepare NATO and the West for the possibility of a Russian attack by releasing all the intelligence, and then led the effort in providing the military assistance, the training, the equipment, the munitions, the intelligence that has allowed Ukraine to withstand the onslaught and in fact push back Russian forces for the last 2 years. And that country was no longer willing, because of its own internal dysfunction, its own paralysis, its own dominance of one party by a particular strand of thinking, to do what was the right thing, even though the Europeans were. They were spending on military aid, they were spending on economic aid. So that was one sort of real problem. And then, of course, the meeting happened a week after Donald Trump publicly said that that those countries that don't, quote, pay their bills, as if this is something that is about paying bills as opposed to thinking about their security in an integrated manner, that he would encourage Russia to do whatever the hell they wanted. And I think there's a realization in Europe that that Donald Trump's influence today is already high, as we can see in the Ukraine vote, or the absence of a Ukraine vote in the House. But if he were to become president, that the United States could no longer be relied upon, and that therefore you needed to think about your own security, your own defense in a way that does not include the United States, or that may not include the United States. And I think the wake-up call that they heard is now there. And my sense is that that will have an influence on European thinking, no matter who wins this election, because Joe Biden certainly has a much more Atlanticist perspective and an alliance perspective, but he may be the last one of U.S. presidents in that mold, and that will have an impact.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I was in Munich too, and very much had a similar set of takeaways. Usually it's Putin who looms large at Munich, but this year it very much felt like Trump was the figure who, you know, wasn't there, wasn't invited, but everyone was talking about. And things have progressed since then. So French President Macron suggested this week that France could send troops to Ukraine. But that was followed by the U.S. immediately saying no way, it wouldn't allow American boots on the ground. Germany said something similar too. What's your sense of how seriously something like that might be considered by other NATO countries? I mean, Denmark, for example, again at Munich, essentially said they would give their entire arsenal to Ukraine.
Yeah, I think there's a huge difference between troops and equipment.
True.
And I do think there is a mood in Europe that because Europe can no longer rely on the United States, they need to figure out whatever they can to provide as much capabilities to the Ukrainians to hold the line and ultimately to change the course of the war in their favor. Importantly, less reported than Macron's remarks about troops was his agreement for the first time to use EU funding to buy non-European produced equipment, which the Czechs have been pushing for. There are artillery shells in other parts of the world that the Ukrainians need. They're just not in Europe. So if you limit EU funding to only buying EU produced or European produced equipment, you limit what you can use it for. That was a major agreement, and I wouldn't call it a concession because it just made sense. But for the French, it was a concession. I see that Macron's statement, frankly, more as political theater than anything real. The French are extremely good at seizing the moment to take the political high ground when it suits them. This is the same president who, not that long ago, talked about the importance of providing Russia with security guarantees, even though it was in the middle of a war, who tried by flying to Moscow to prevent the war. I remember sitting on that big white table on one end and being lectured at for 3 hours. And it's the same country that when I was at NATO and we were discussing whether or not to intervene in Libya,
After a meeting that the president of France, then Nicolas Sarkozy, had called, announced at the end of the meeting, oh, by the way, my French fighter planes are now in the air starting bombing the Libyans. Not that France could do this by itself. It was the kind of political theater that that the French love. And I see Macron pushing that. I also note that not only did the Germans say no, but the Germans have been saying for months, maybe the French should give a little bit more equipment, since their actual contribution to the Ukrainians in terms of direct military aid is significantly less than most others, including Germany, which is the second largest provider of military aid and equipment and economic aid and equipment to Ukraine.
Ivo, you're such a close follower of the war in Ukraine. And, you know, what I've heard from a lot of Ukrainians over the last few weeks is that things haven't been this bad in terms of, you know, the war front since, you know, the start of the war. And morale is down. There's a real sense that they're running out of ammunition. They need more weaponry. They're not getting it. How much of that do you see as, you know, facts on the ground versus Ukraine advocating for more support from Europe and from the United States? And, you know, given all of that, what's your sense of trajectory in the next few months for the war?
Yeah, I know. I agree with you that morale is low and concern about the war is high in Ukraine, and for good reason. Remember, we have not funded and provided any aid, military aid, with new funds since the beginning of last year. The request to send more funds went up to Capitol Hill in September. It's been sitting there, just like our funding issues for our government has been deadlocked by the reality of a dysfunctional caucus on among Republicans on the House side. And so that aid is critical because, frankly, the only ones who have for the immediate future the quantity of artillery shells and other munitions, as well as critical air defense systems, is the U.S. It's not that the Europeans aren't doing it because they could. They're not doing it because they can't. They're providing everything they can. They just don't have 155 millimeter artillery shells, of which the Ukrainians need a whole bunch more. They're outgunned 5 to 6 to 1 when it comes to artillery shells. And that's a big deal when you're in a war of attrition, which is what this is. This is not a high maneuver war. This is a war of attrition. So there is a reason, and I think it's real, for them to be despondent. I'm despondent. I think everybody else is despondent. And knows that that our aid is absolutely crucial. The question is, you know, what can the Ukrainians do in the next 2 to 3 or 4 months vis-a-vis, on the battlefield? And you know, by all measures, while the Russians are larger, bigger, stronger, offense is hard. And breaking through, really breaking through, as opposed to getting a kilometer here or a village there, is going to be difficult. And by most estimates of people who follow this very closely, the ability of the Russians to do anything major before the summer is small, unless the Ukrainian defense collapses, which is pretty unlikely, but of course always possible. And now the second half of the year becomes more dire, because by that time, whatever reserves are left over will have been depleted. And Russian forces may have been able to strengthen themselves. So there's two things that need to happen. One, the Ukrainians need to do, which is they need more men at the front. And that means mobilizing more manpower. They have a draft that only starts at age 27. There's a bill now being thought about of lowering that to age 25. There are also a significant number of Ukrainian men who are not in Ukraine. And it would be good if that is one part of it. But the second that needs to happen is they need weapons. They don't need troops on the ground, although if we did provide troops on the ground, we'd win the war pretty quickly. except that it might escalate to nuclear war, and no one wants that, which is why we're not getting involved on the ground. But if we provide the equipment, then there, which we can, with the Congress doing what it should do, which an overwhelming majority of Congress wants it to do, which the American people believe it needs to do, Ukraine will have the military aid to withstand the assault, not only now, but through the end of the year, and then perhaps be in a position to rebuild itself and take offensive action. Ukraine will get this year soon F-16s. That they have been training on. These are fighter aircraft, and the ability for Ukraine to use those aircraft to shoot Russian planes out of the sky, as they are part of their ability to try to push through Ukrainian defenses, will make a big difference. So this is not a lost cause at all. But we, the U.S., need to stand up, because we're the only ones, together with the Ukrainians who are fighting, standing in the way of the potential of Ukraine losing. And it can lose the war, and that would be a strategic disaster, not just for Ukraine, not just for Europe, but frankly for the United States. We've been here before. Big wars in Europe don't end with the United States staying at home. They end by the United States getting involved in those big wars itself. That's what happened in World War One. That's what happened in World War Two. What we want to do is to prevent World War Three.
Indeed. Well said, Ivo. You know, one of the themes sort of underpinning this whole conversation is what Americans are thinking about U.S. involvement around the world, and how that impacts policy and vice versa. And, you know, the other thing in the news this week is the Michigan primary results. And one of the things to emerge from there was that for President Biden, there was a clear group of Democratic voters in Michigan who voted uncommitted. Many of these people are Arab Americans, many are Muslims who are disappointed with U.S. policy in the Middle East. They think Biden should be calling for a ceasefire. They think he could be doing a lot more to prevent the suffering that is so clearly underway in Gaza. And I'm curious how you are watching that. I mean, on the one hand, we've been discussing how U.S. sentiment globally is sort of shifting along the margins, the way in which successive American governments have thought about their role in the world. I mean, Afghanistan being case in point. Do you sense that this year, President Biden is looking at those results from Michigan, and it might move the needle in terms of how he acts?
I mean, clearly the results in Michigan are, you know, not unexpected, but a demonstration of deep, deep unhappiness in a certain part of the Democratic constituency, and indeed in the country, about what is happening in Gaza, what Israel is doing, and how the United States has responded to it. And this is both, I think, demographically the case, where younger voters in particular are rightly, in my view, upset about and deeply affected by the horrendous suffering of the people in Gaza, none of whom are deserve what they have. They are victims not only of Israel, but of course also of Hamas, which started this war with its own incredible brutality and barbarism. But there is a rightful change in concern, which I think many in the Biden administration, including President Scheer, the question that the administration keeps asking itself, and will now, I think, reinforce asking itself, how do we affect Israeli decision-making to get the right outcome? And the right outcome is an end to the fighting that leads to a situation inside Gaza that does not pose a long-term threat to Israel's security that we saw happen on October 7th. To date, the Biden administration and the president himself in particular have argued that the best way to influence Israel is by supporting its right to self-defense and trying to use that support as a means to push them into a direction about how they are fighting, and more importantly, trying to start to refocus on hostage release and a temporary, if not a long-term, pause in the fighting, so more humanitarian aid can be provided. So the U.S. vetoed the ceasefire resolution at the UN a couple of weeks ago, not because they actually are against the ceasefire per se, but because they thought that the only way to get to a ceasefire is by having a temporary pause that focuses on hostages and then transfer that into a long-term ceasefire. That's their strategy. I'm glad I don't have to make the decisions that they have to make. These are very, very tough decisions. I think the U.S. is dealing with an Israeli government that does not always have the best interest of the Israeli people, let alone the people in Gaza, foremost in mind, but a government that is focused on its own political interests, and particularly the interests of the prime minister. So that makes it devilishly complicated. But they got to figure out a way to stop this and to change course pretty soon, because I think it was Tom Friedman today in the New York Times wrote presciently, the view of Israel around the globe is extraordinarily negative. But the view of the United States as a result of that is also becoming increasingly negative. And that's not good for the United States. It's not good for Israel, by the way. It's not good for the world. And so I do think that the time for a rethink and to say, is this a government we can work with, this Israeli government, or should we do something else, is coming very close.
It is indeed. I also, like Tom Friedman, was on the road for the last 2 weeks outside the country, and the assessments of America's place in the world really seem to have gotten worse recently, and that's cause for worry. Ivo Dalder, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you, as always, for your thoughts and your wisdom.
Robbie, it's great to be with you, and great to have your audience ask the questions and have this discussion. Look forward to do it again soon.
You bet. My pleasure. And that was Ivo Dalder, the CEO of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. As always, if you want to know who's coming up in future episodes of FP Live, head to foreignpolicy.com. As you know, we conduct these interviews live and on video. We often plan them out weeks ahead of time. The podcast version of FP Live is produced by Rosie Julin, and the executive producer of FP Live is Tal Alroy. I'm Ravi Agrawal. I will see you next time.
The first teller of my story is me.
This week on Disorder.
In this new world, when military power will be connected with high tech, small states can be very, very powerful.
Could small states help order the world?
Small states could be as effective, as dangerous as the big ones.
To find out, we're joined by Dr. Armen Sarkisian, Armenia's former president and prime minister.
In our two-part series, we discuss the history of the Armenian genocide,
the ongoing conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh,
and why small states could be the answer to the disorder in our world.
The big powers today have to compete in order to attract the small states to be their allies.
You can get Disorder wherever you get your podcasts, or you can follow the link in the show notes.